This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
An interesting midrash last night, which I want to expand on today, this evening. It extends further. You remember we had a series a little while ago on barriers and intimacies, and deals with the sense of alienation that exists among people today. The sense of alienation is not anything new. It's something which people have spoken about and written about already for many years. In a way, the sense of alienation has become worse, and in part it's become worse because we've learned how to handle it. But learning how to handle it hasn't meant that we've learned how to overcome it. All that it means is we've learned how to conduct ourselves as if it doesn't exist, which makes it a lot worse. And last night we had a very beautiful medrash that actually taught the methods of overcoming these alienations. The problem with alienation is several fold. Firstly, as we discussed last night, it applies within family life. That when there's a sense of alienation, you find a situation where where family members are relating to each other within certain limitations, and not really achieving any degree of intimate understanding and knowledge of one another. And the result of that is that even within the family, not only is there a lack of understanding, which has its own problems, but there's also an enormous sense of aloneness that people experience. And the fact that they are physically surrounded by people doesn't ease that sense of aloneness. And outside of the family, the problem is also there. In a social sense, we discussed last night how people have become socially inept. We actually don't know how to handle one another. And so we follow formalities. There are sort of formulas that we use in order to interrelate with one another, and we follow the formulas, and they work successfully in the sense that we don't stamp on any toes, and we don't really get to know people either. And that creates a social loneliness, that creates a social sense of alienation. So then you find that people are not really getting any kind of meaningful input from one another. They're not getting any kind of meaningful feedback from one another. And that has all sorts of repercussions. People function in a very negative way when they're not getting positive input from people. And people are really the only source of positive input. One doesn't get positive input from anything but people. And we've lost the art of being able to give that positive input and of being able to give it consistently. Somebody commented at the Kiddush this morning, we were discussing the attitude of cashiers at supermarkets. Okay, if anybody who's been to a supermarket and dealt with a cashier knows what her attitude is. But have a look at it from her side. Have a look at what she's confronted with in a day's work. She has a continuous line of people in front of her, one after the other. She doesn't engage in any conversation with them, and they don't engage in any conversation with her. She is the only human face of the supermarket. So any complaints that anybody has about the supermarket, they direct at her, although she has nothing to do with it. If somebody couldn't find what they wanted on the shelf, they complain to the cashier. If prices have gone up, there's a little snide remark to the cashier. Every time I come, it's more expensive. Always something to say, and something negative usually. The service here, and then she gets an item, and the price isn't marked on it, and she has to ring a little bell and call somebody, and you're there, and you mutter under your breath once again. So she's constantly exposed to people all day muttering under their breath something negative to her. You know, what's she expected to feel like day after day after day after day of that? There's no way she can be cheerful. There's no way that she can be positive. Now that little interaction of the cashier at the supermarket is really a cameo, like a microcosm of life in general. Because if you analyze what most people put up with during a day's work, it's more or less that. And it's not just at work. Then they come home. And then it also starts very often at home. And the wife's had a day like that, or the mother's had a day and she cooks supper, and one of the children have got something to say about how they don't like this and they don't like that. And one thinks, well, it's not terribly serious, it's the family expressing their opinions, but it's another knock. And then the husband will say something about whether something he doesn't like about something or other, and she'll say something. If you work out how much negative we're exposed to in a normal day's experience, from the time we get up until the time we go to sleep, work out how much negative and how much positive. How often it happens that somebody says something really nice to you and really means it, and really cheerful. How often that happens, and just work out what kind of people we're becoming when you realize that we react to that, we respond to that. It's not possible to go through this day after day after day of negative input, or even almost worse than negative input is being ignored, is no input at all, just being totally marginalized. And how much of the time that happens, and one begins to realize that it's very, very difficult. And we're experiencing this in all areas of life, that people are not able to establish meaningful relationships, not short term, very short term. By very short term, I mean like with a lady at the cashier at the supermarket, and I mean longer term relationships as well. As far as the short term relationships with the lady at the cashier in the supermarket is concerned, she puts up her barriers. She wants to protect herself against you because she sees you coming up. Usually, if you watch the faces of people, in fact it's an interesting thing to do, take the time to do it next time you're there. When you're finished with the cashier, don't run to your car. Stand behind her and watch the line. Actually watch the faces of the people standing in the line, and ask yourself how you would feel if you were faced with faces like that all day. And then remember, you were one of those faces just a moment ago, dull and negative and angry and frustrated and cross. So she doesn't want to be hurt by that, so she puts up a barrier. She becomes a machine. She's not going to be influenced by all this, so she operates as if she's a robot, as if she's noticing all this. And you come up to her now, she's the robot, so there is no relationship. You don't start the relationship, and so the whole thing develops. We put up barriers, and that prevents a relationship developing. We don't penetrate those barriers, so the relationship doesn't develop. And we're doing the same thing in home situations. We're doing the same thing in almost all the different areas in which we operate. And yesterday I spoke also about the dating scene. And with very little difference, it applies equally in the religious dating scene and in the non-religious dating scene. The formulas are different. The formalities are different. The way one goes about pretending that you're getting to know each other are different. Very different. But in both cases, it's a pretense. In both cases, it's not really getting to know one another. And this was the Medrash that we learnt. Medrash asks why the connection between Sefer Vayikra, starting with the word Vayikra El Moshe, and he called to Moshe, starting with a Vav, and he called to Moshe, implying that the first sentence of this Sefer is an immediate continuation of the last sentence of the previous Parsha. Maksiv Lamala Minyan, what did we read just before this? Parsha's Mishkan. We were learning about the Mishkan. And what did we learn in the Mishkan? Normally when we learn about the Mishkan, it's quite dry stuff. It's specifications, it's building, it's architecture, it's engineering. It's not very exciting. But each time it says there, after every section of the construction, Kasher Tzivo Hashem Es Moshe. Moshe built it as God instructed him. Moshe L'melech Shitzivo Es Avdoi. This can be compared to a king who commanded his servant for Omale and said to him, Beneli Paltin, build me a palace. I'll call Dovo Vadovo Shahoyobene Hoyokesiv Olof Shmoishal Melech. And whatever he built, he used to write the name of the king on it. He put up the walls and he wrote the name, and he put the crest of the king on every wall. He put up the pillars and he put the crest of the king on top of every pillar. He put the beams for the ceiling, and on every beam he put the crest of the king. Eventually, Nichnas Hamelech L'Toich Paltin. Eventually, the king comes into the palace. Al Kol Dovah V'Dovah Shoyom Mabito Yom Etzer Shmoy Kosov Olav. And wherever he looked, he saw his name. Now, we would imagine if the story stopped here, we would imagine that the Medrash is going to go on and say, "What an arrogant, egoistic king!" That's what one would imagine. That this is a negative story. All he's got to do, and he's so proud. The king is so proud that his name is all over the place. Why should that be important? The Medrash doesn't do that quite. The Yom Nid, he eventually comes in, sees his name on everything. Omar, and he says, Kol HaKoved Azeh Oso Li'Avdi V'Anim B'Bifnim V'Hu Mibachutz. All this honor my servant has given to me, and I am inside and he's outside. Call him and tell him to come right into my private chambers. Invite him in. So he extends an invitation to the builder to come right into the palace. And then the Midrash goes on to say, the same when Hashem built the Mishkan. On everything that Moshe built, it says he did it like Hashem instructed. All this honor that Moshe has done for me, and I'm inside and he's outside. Call him to come right inside. So we see that it's not negative. We see that the response of the king to his name being plastered all over the palace is not a negative thing. What's important is how he responds to it. He doesn't respond to it by becoming still more arrogant. He responds to it by inviting the lowly builder to come and join him in his private chambers. So that honor given to him in fact inspires him with a measure of humility. It's not normal for the king to invite a builder into his private chambers, but this king does invite the builder into his private chambers. So we have a situation where the honor in fact develops humility in the person. That's what we need to look at this evening, this strange relationship between honor and humility. And we see the same kibyocha with Hashem. Hashem puts up the Mishkan. Moshe gives Hashem a great deal of honor in the way he constructs it. We'll discuss in a moment what that honor is. Hashem doesn't say, oh, but honor is not important to me. I'm a very righteous being. I'm the Ribono Shel Olam himself, so honor is not important to me. He doesn't. He values that honor. And he responds and says, Moshe has given me such honor, let me invite Moshe in. Just like the king doesn't say, honor doesn't mean anything to me. He must run away from honor. I'm not impressed with my name all over the place. It means nothing to me. He doesn't say that, the king. The king is gratified and says, so much honor this builder has given me, I must recognize that honor, I must invite him in. So he responds to the honor with humility. He doesn't pretend the honor doesn't exist. We've talked many times before about the importance of not denying the existence of feelings. And the feeling that one has when one is being honored is something that sometimes one thinks one's supposed to deny that feeling. Not supposed to feel honored. Not so. You're supposed to accept that feeling but respond with a great deal of gratitude and humility, which is what the king does. And invites the person in who's shown him that honor. And we discussed last night, what is a Mishkan? And we explained that a Mishkan, apart from many, many other meanings to it, some we understand and many we don't understand, but one of the meanings of the Mishkan is that Hashem has a place in the world. And we know that Molei Chol Ha'aretz Kavoda, the whole universe is full of Hashem. So what does it mean Hashem has a place? It doesn't mean that he's nowhere else. What it means is that he has a private place. A person can have a place that he's all over the place, but he still has a private place. You can have a balabos who's the owner of a large factory. It's all his. Wherever he goes, it's his. But he still wants a little office where he can close the door and sit down and do some work on his own or speak to somebody in privacy. That's his office. So you say, that's the boss's office. So what is the boss's office? The whole place is the boss's. Doesn't matter, but that's the place where nobody else is allowed to go. The whole place is his, it's true, but we're also allowed to walk there. Into that place, nobody else is allowed to go. He has privacy. And the Mishkan is, so to say, a concept of Hashem's privacy. This is my place. This is Hashem's place. Not to say that he isn't everywhere. Of course he's everywhere. But we're also everywhere. Whereas in this place, only Hashem. We can't go in there. It's the construction of barriers of privacy, even for the Ribono Shel Olam himself. So that we need to understand the concept of human privacy is not something which is a concession to human weakness. The concept of human privacy is an acknowledgement of human godliness. Because in the concept of privacy there is godliness. The Ribono Shel Olam kibyochel, so to say, the Ribono Shel Olam himself needs a place which is only his. He wants a place which is only his. And so every human being, every person needs a place which is only his. There is a view, and I don't know how well it's been proved, but it certainly seems to have a basis to it, that a lot of the corruption and crime and negativity that one finds in large cities all over the world is because of overcrowding. These people are just on top of each other. And people just don't function well when they're on top of each other. People need space. People need privacy. People need a place that's not invaded. And when that's absent, they behave in funny ways. And one needs to understand, as I say, I don't know to what extent that's been proved, but it certainly seems right You sometimes see families moving from small apartments into homes, and you see the behavior of the children changes immediately. The whole family becomes more relaxed. People need space. People need the ability to move around. And the way we live in the in crowded cities is not natural. It's not normal. People need privacy. One needs privacy within a family. The members of a family need privacy. Even a husband and a wife need privacy from one another. Parents and children need privacy from one another. And the family needs privacy from the outside. And even the Ribbono Shel Olam, so to say, needs privacy. What do we do? How do we construct our privacy? Leaving aside the actual physical barriers of locking a door. How do we construct our privacy? How do we cope with going about public activities and still retain our sense of privacy? The way we do it is by the equivalent of the construction of the palace. What is the palace? On the one hand, the palace is walls. It's barriers, you can't get in. It's a sense of privacy that you can't come in here, this is only my place. There's security guards outside, there's a sense of privacy. They're talking nowadays, and particularly in South Africa, they're talking all over the world, but one sees that South Africa is apparently leading in the field. They call it cocooning. People are beginning to cocoon themselves into their homes. They're beginning to find more fulfillment in their own homes than outside. They're actually making nice environments out of their homes. Even small homes and poorer homes are beginning to create little oases of privacy where they don't have to go out, where they can entertain themselves and feel comfortable and feel relaxed within their physical, within their home environment. And that's the palace, in a sense. This is my place and nobody comes in here. But there's something else that a palace has as well. That's why it says it's a paltin. It's not just a house. We're not just talking about the king asking him to build a room or to build a yard for him. He's building a paltin. What is a paltin? A paltin is a structure that also conveys a certain pride and dignity and honor. That's the king's house. It's a choshuva looking place, a palace. And that's part of the requirement. That's part of the way we build our privacy, is by creating around ourselves a fence, which is not just a fence for the sake of keeping people away, but it's also a fence of saying, I am important. That's how we keep people away. And we're almost saying that if you don't regard me as important, I regard myself as important. There's the dignity, the honor, the respect, and sometimes the role playing that we do is all an attempt to say, keep a distance, keep away from me. The Medrash very often uses, almost always, whenever it gives an example and a story, it says Melech. It doesn't give a case of an ordinary person, always a king, because there's something princely about each of us. There's something royal about each of us. There is an element of royalty in the way we function, and we need to acknowledge the royal aspirations of human beings in order to truly understand how they function. And we all like to have thrones, and we all like to live in palaces, and we all like to wear robes. Otherwise the fashion industry wouldn't have a chance, and the office furniture industry wouldn't have a chance, and the architectural industry wouldn't have a chance. Within our budgets, we all do that kind of thing. We build ourselves palaces and throne rooms and robes. Image is important to us. And the image we construct around ourselves is saying to the other person, what we really are saying is, watch my dignity. Careful where you step, because I'm an important person, at least to myself. That's what one is saying with that. Watch my dignity. Now, that message is a very difficult one to handle. Because if somebody comes to, if I'm relating to somebody, and he or she are busy saying, watch my dignity, careful where you go, there's not very much one can do. That's a distance. You can't really impinge on that distance. So what do we tend to do? One of two things. Either we respect that dignity and we don't impinge, and we function like people function in the northern European countries, where everything is very formal and very dignified and very cold, and people don't really get to know each other, and you can just about have husbands and wives who've lived together for 50 years still calling each other Mr. So-and-so and Mrs. So-and-so. Or we take the opposite view, like the Americans do, and we just ignore the barriers completely and ignore the dignity completely and pull the barriers down and we just plow in. And we reduce people. In Israel, that's also a tendency. That was almost done deliberately there when the state was originally founded. That everybody's the same. Once you start saying everybody's the same, then you've got to accept that everybody's brought down to the lowest level, not everybody's elevated to the highest level, because you can't elevate everybody to the highest level. So once you start preaching that everybody's the same, you've got to remove dignity. You've got to remove nobility. You've got to remove aristocracy. You've got to bring everybody down to the level of the drug addict dropout in the slums of the town. That's, if you're going to go for equality, that's the level at which you've got to relate to everybody. There can be no dignity, there can be no specialness, there can be no uniqueness. And neither of those approaches are okay. Either we destroy that person's barrier, the person puts up a barrier of dignity, and we can destroy that barrier, and in the process we can unnerve the person terribly, or we can respect that barrier and maintain a distance, in which case we never achieve intimacy. That is the dilemma of interpersonal relationships that we battle with, and that is the creation of that alienation. I think, by the way, that one of the other negatives of the American system is that when you break down those barriers, people don't have a chance to develop depth. It's like you break a container. If you break a container, you can't fill it up. One needs boundaries in order to develop depth. One needs limitations. One needs to have place to do that. And if one's living in a fishbowl and one achieves intimacy with everybody, the first time you meet somebody on a bus, you're on first name terms and you're really telling them all about your most intimate details, what that really means is that there is no depth to that intimacy, because people don't have a chance to actually develop that depth within themselves. It's also very destructive and very negative. How is that? What are we taught in the Medrash? How does it function here? The king says, build me a palace. What does the man come along and do? He builds a palace and he imprints the name of the king on every pillar, on every wall, on every beam. What is he doing and what is he saying? Firstly, the role of the name is important. And we know, anybody who's dealt with people knows how important a name is to people. How upset people are if you get the spelling of their name wrong when you write them letters. The power that has been developed in the through the word processing system, whereby you get these personalized mass letters. Everybody knows what they are, and yet they're still one step better than the circulars that you get that don't have your name on it. People still fall for it. The name is very important, and the builder stamps the name of the king on every aspect of the palace. So he's not just building a palace. What he's saying is a number of things. He's saying, I'm building the palace. I'm building the palace for you, the way you want it, with your name on every part of it. That's what I'm doing. This is something that is yours. I respect that, and I'm helping you build your own image. Now, in image building, you have to be very careful, because if I help you build your image, there's a strong possibility that you're going to land up with my image, not with yours. And that's something one has to be very careful about. That means in the relationship, the builder always realizes the king is at center stage. I'm just the builder. And my job is to build a king's palace. And my job is to make sure that the king is comfortable in it. Very often an architect puts his own imprint on the building. This is my building. Who built this building? Whose building? Who was the architect? That's what he wanted to avoid. When people came past this building, he didn't want them to say so-and-so was the architect. He wanted them to say so-and-so is the king. This is where he lives. So he builds the whole thing with sensitivity to the image of the king, not to his own image, to the dignity and the esteem of the other person. And it's that he focuses on, and in every element of the building and every aspect of the building, he imprints the name of the Balabos. He imprints the name of the king. This is his building. He uses the name, and he indelibly imprints that name into the building, that anybody ever seeing that building will know immediately and will be struck with the uniqueness of that building, but which belongs to the Melech, which belongs to the king. His part of it is irrelevant. He plays a support role. The king is at center stage. And we need to understand that the only time a person opens up, as the king does, how does the king respond to that? The king doesn't just move into his palace and say thank you very much. The king invites him in. We need to understand that the only time that we invite another person into our private areas is when we feel satisfied that the other person is concerned and caring about us, not about them. That's very, very important. Because the reason that we keep people away from us, the reason that we keep people outside of us, is because we're afraid. We're afraid of them being hurtful. We're afraid of them being negligent. We're afraid of them using us. There are all sorts of reasons that we don't want to, that we keep that kind of a distance. The only time we're going to allow somebody to come close is when we feel that that person is concerned with us, not with them. People will get close to psychologists. People will get close to doctors, if the psychologists and the doctors are skillful, to counselors, to rabbis. Why is that? Because the professional communication is one of, I'm here to help you. That's it. I'm here to solve your problems. It's not a friendship. It's not something that they feel might be exploited, and if they do feel it might be exploited, they don't develop that closeness. But it doesn't need to be. The fact that we have so many helping professions today is an indictment of our society. We shouldn't need helping professions. We should be helping each other. That's what friendships are supposed to be about. If people had solid friendships, they wouldn't need psychologists. If society was solid, one wouldn't need psychologists and so many psychiatrists, and even the roles of rabbis would be very different. It's not, that should not be their function. That should be society's function. So people are coming to professionals to buy friendship. It's actually very pathetic. They're coming to pay a fee. We discussed at the I think at a previous, might have been at the Eve Shir, when I made mention of these telephone chat lines that cost an awful lot of money and are doing very, very good business. And people are using them not for sexual reasons, as one would normally imagine and as they are advertised. Recent surveys they've done show that people are using them to talk, just for companionship, because if I pay this person, well, they're doing it professionally, number one, they don't know me. In other words, people feel comfortable with that distance. The person isn't going to take advantage of me. There's a comfort with that kind. It's actually pathetic when you realize what a large industry it is, how much money lonely people are paying just to have somebody to speak to on the other side of the telephone. It's very, very pathetic. And the same is with psychologists, and the same is with rabbonim. People are coming to professionals to get from them what they ought to be getting from their friends and relations. From their wives, from their husbands, from their children, from their parents, and from their friends. And they're not getting it. What is it that they're not getting? They're not getting the sense that I care about you. They might be getting the sense that I care about you. That you hear people saying very often. I care about you, with the emphasis on the word care. But that's not enough. What people need, the message people need to be communicating is, I care about you, not I care about you. I care about you. Saying I care about you, that's like saying I care about whales. I care about panda bears in China. I care about my puppy and I care about you too. It doesn't mean anything. When you say I care about you, that does mean something. But you very seldom hear that being said. When people use that phrase, you very seldom hear that emphasized. I care about you. My focus is on you, not on me, on you. And as we discussed last night, if you watch people's body language when they're interacting, and particularly in the dating arena, both religious and non-religious, what you're aware of is exactly the opposite. I care about me. That's all I'm interested in. Am I having a good time? Am I making a good impression? Am I coming over properly? Am I communicating correctly? That's what's coming. Is she going to want to go out with me again? Why? Not because I care about her, but because I care about me, because I want to go out again with her. Will she agree to that? The focus is, and the same way the other way around, from the girl to the boy, the focus is not in the other direction. Is the other person having a good time? Is she feeling comfortable? Is she okay? Is she feeling important? Is she feeling respected? Is she feeling dignified? That's not the focus. And that's what we find in business relationships. It's the same. That's the essence of proper customer relationships, isn't it? To be able to put yourself in the role of the customer and be concerned all the time. How is he feeling? Is he enjoying doing business with me? Is he getting a good deal? Is he satisfied with the business we're doing together? That's not the way people are thinking. People are thinking, how much am I making out of this deal? is this customer going to come back to me? If you're lucky already, the furthest we'll go in customer service is, will this customer come back to me again? Why? Because I want the customer back again. Not because of whether I care about the customer, I care about the other person. Caring, yes, I care about him, sure, as we said. Like I care about my bank account, and I care about my puppy at home, I care about my customer. But do I care about him? Is the emphasis on the object of my caring? That's the problem. When the king walked into the palace, one thing became clear. The architect cared about the king, not cared about the king. Sure, he cared about the king. All architects care about their customers, about their clients, because if they didn't care about their clients, they would get no work. That's the only reason they care about their clients. So the architect says, I care about my clients. And if he's a very good architect, he'll say, I care about my clients. But you'll never hear him say, I care about my clients. That's who I care about. Nobody else is important. Only him. That you don't hear him say. And when the king walked in, that's the feeling he got. This architect cared about me, not about anybody else. The moment a person feels that you care about them, the doors open up. In that case, I can let you in. You'll be careful. You understand me? I don't need to communicate my dignity and my honor and my respect to you because you're sensitive to it already. It's not necessary. And so we find that what breeds arrogance is a person's need to emphasize his own importance. What breeds humility is other people emphasizing his importance for him. We think sometimes if we show honor to somebody, he might get arrogant. Doesn't work that way. If he shows honor to himself, he'll get arrogant. If you show honor to him, he gets humble. He doesn't get arrogant. That creates humility. The king says, this architect has put Kovadaz there, all this honor. What is that honor? What is that dignity? He's put my name all over the place. This is my building. He's taken backstage. He's put me at center stage. He cares about me. Call him in. Lift him. Let him come right inside. And let him share this with me. Let him be right inside. I have nothing to hide from him. I want to share this with him. And the same way Moshe relates to the Ribbono Shel Olam. He doesn't write Hashem's name on everything. Here it's the other way around. Hashem writes in the Torah. On every phase of the construction of the Mishkan, Kasher Tzivu Hashem es Moshe. This was built just as Hashem commanded Moshe. So what is Moshe doing to honor Hashem? He's building a Mishkan. He's building these barriers. He's building this house of privacy. How is he doing it? Kasher Tzivu Hashem. He's doing it in accordance with God's specifications, not his specifications. When you want to show honor to the other person, check what he regards as being the honor. Different people have different ways of appreciating honor. And you need to do it not the way you would want to be honored. You've got to honor him the way you understand he wants to be honored. It's Kasher Tzivu Hashem es Moshe. Moshe kept on looking to make sure that he was building it in accordance with Hashem's description, with Hashem's desire, with Hashem's will. And the result of that is that on every aspect of the Mishkan there was, so to say, imprinted God's name. It was all done for him, it was done for Hashem, it wasn't done for Moshe. People didn't look at the Mishkan and say, this is Moshe's Mishkan. They looked at it and they said, this is Hashem's Mishkan. Hashem at center stage, not Moshe. The result of that is Hashem invites Moshe in. And as we pointed out last night, the essence of intimacy is not to break down the barrier, it's to be invited inside. Without the barrier, there's no intimacy. If the boss doesn't have a private office, then there's nothing intimate about the boss stopping to have a word with you. It's only if he has a private office and he says, please come and have a cup of tea with me, and he sits you down in his office and has a word with you, then there's intimacy. Why? Because there is a barrier and you've been invited behind the barrier with the other person. That creates intimacy. Remove the barrier and there's no intimacy. It's not remove the barrier and there is intimacy. But we have to work out how to be invited behind that barrier. We've got to work out how to get our husbands and wives to invite us behind that barrier. How to get our parents and children to invite us behind that barrier. How to get our colleagues at work to invite us behind that barrier. How to get the cashier at the cash register at the supermarket to invite us behind that barrier. How to get our friends to invite us behind that barrier. Only that is going to solve that sense of aloneness, that enormous sense of alienation that people feel by not relating to one another properly. And how do we do it? By showing honor and dignity. By showing value, by showing respect for what that person's doing. You try it out one day. And next time you're at the supermarket, you go up to the cashier and say something that shows a sense of dignity that you appreciate for the importance of the work that she's doing, and that she's doing it to the best of her ability, and that she's accurate, and what kind of a difference that makes, and what a pleasure it is. Try it that way around. Don't wait for her to smile. She's at a disadvantage because you're the 2,000th customer, scowling customer she's had that day already. So it's hard to expect her to do the smiling. For you, it's your first interaction with her. So you start off. And do it by the covert. Say something that makes her feel special. Say something that makes her feel unique. Say something that makes her feel that she's not just one of a whole line of them, which is what she's made to feel all the time. Make her feel she's a little different and she's a little bit special. And see whether she smiles at you. And see how she relates to you. And see if she invites you in and starts a conversation. And the result of that is not only that you'll get better service from her, the result is you'll also go away less dehumanized. You also will feel you've had human interaction. You haven't been dealing with a machine. You've actually dealt with a real human being. And if it works with her, just imagine how it can work with the more intimate relationships that one has with one's friends, with one's colleagues, with one's relatives, with one's own family. Just figure out what a power that can have when you've tried it out on such simple areas as that. And how far does it go? The Medrash says, the Medrash comes in many places, one of it is in the beginning of Rus, that Chazal instituted the fact that when you greet somebody, you use Hashem's name. You know how meticulous we are about using Hashem's name. We don't use Hashem's name for anything. We're careful when we say it, we're careful when we write it, we're careful how we pronounce it. Hashem's name we're very, very meticulous with. How is it that the word for greeting a person, the hello, is Sholo, which is the name of Hashem? How come we're allowed to use Hashem's name for something so ordinary? And the Medrash says that's one of the things that Chazal instituted that Hashem agreed with. And one of the first people to use it was Boaz when he says to his employees, Hashem Imochim, God be with you. And the reason we need to understand is not because if it was just a matter of a formality, that's the word you use, we wouldn't be allowed to do that. That wouldn't be allowed. The reason we're allowed to do that is because in greeting another person, what we really are saying is, I recognize the godliness within you. That's what we're saying. Animals don't greet each other. Human beings greet each other. So what is unique about human beings that make this an important interreaction? That's because we're recognizing the godliness. When we're saying Shalom Aleichem, we're not just saying peace be to you. That's not what we're saying. That's the meaning of that Chazal that was decided that we use Hashem's name. When we say Shalom Aleichem, we're saying God is upon you. I see God in you. There's godliness I see in you. You try telling a person like that. You try telling a person that. And see how he acts. See how he behaves as a result of that. What kind of behavior you're able to elicit from him when you're conveying that message to him. And not just by a formality of saying Shalom Aleichem, but by the way you treat him constantly. If you're constantly communicating to him, I see godliness in you, how is he going to act towards you? He's going to live up to that. He's going to want to live up to that. We can't expect people to behave in a godly fashion if we treat them like animals. If you treat a person like an animal, you can expect him to behave like an animal. If we treat a person where we're saying Shalom Aleichem, if we understand what we mean when we're saying Shalom Aleichem, and that's how we treat people, we can expect a godly kind of response from people. That's why using Hashem's name is allowed when you greet people. And it goes so far that the halacha is, Kivan she yiyaz man tefila l'shulchan aruch says in Siman Peites, once davening time comes in the morning, osul l'odom l'hakdim l'fesach chaveru lisein l'sholem. You're not allowed to go to somebody else and say shalom to him until you've davened. Because God's name is Shalom. And the Gemara in Brochus, that's worded slightly differently. There it says, "Ki'ilu bono bomo." It's as if he's built a bomo. A bomo is an altar outside of the confines of the Beis Hamikdash. And we're not allowed to do that. Before the Beis Hamikdash was there, we were allowed to build altars all over the place. Now we're not allowed to do that anymore. So what does that phrase mean? If I go to somebody else's house and I say Shalom to him, that's as if I've constructed an altar outside of the Beis Hamikdash. Why is that so? Because what am I doing? I'm acknowledging godliness in the wrong place. First you go to shul and you daven. But after I've davened, what is it like then? Then I'm allowed to say shalom to him, and then it's not like a bomo. What is it then? It's still a religious act. That's what we need to understand in that Chazal. But it's like a religious act, and doing it before you've davened means you're putting the worship of God in an informal area before your formal worship. That we're not allowed to do. You've got to daven first. You've got to go to shul first. But having davened, then you do greet the person, and that is also an act of worship. That is also a spiritual act, a religious act, when we say shalom to somebody else. Because I'm recognizing godliness in that person. We say it, but we say it in a cliche sort of way where we don't understand what we're saying. There's so much that we say that we don't listen to ourselves. We say and we recognize that the human being is fascinating, that there's so much godliness in the human being, that the human being is the most amazing creature. We talk about the human brain. We talk about the human personality. But if you think of the human brain alone, that's enough to realize that there is nothing in the world so complex and so divine as the human brain. Nothing in the whole world. And you find people going to enormous lengths to experience godliness. So sometimes they do it in the direct way. Come to shul, they daven, it's fine. Sometimes they'll go further, they'll get involved in mysticism to experience godliness. Sometimes they'll get involved in nature, they'll go to see spectacular views, to go and see mountains in Switzerland or the Himalayas or whatever it is. And they're doing that because they want to be moved by the enormity and the almost the sanctity of the Ribbono Shel Olam, which they see expressed in the Bria. We go to great lengths to be moved by the Gadlus HaBoire. And sometimes we see amazing things and it moves us enormously. One sees I spoke about it when I came back from the United States, when one sees some of these films that they've made in outer space, of how the world looks from outer space, how Earth looks from outer space, various other different aspects. And you look at this and you think, my goodness, the Gadlus HaBoire, the greatness of the Ribbono Shel Olam. You look up into the sky and you look at the stars, and if you look at it with a telescope and you've got somebody who can point a few things out to you, goodness, the Gadlus HaBoire, the greatness of the Ribbono Shel Olam. You don't have to go looking so far. Look at a human being. There's no more Gadlus HaBoire that you'll ever see than in another human being. The whole universe with all its stars and the planets and the solar system and the Milky Way and all the different galaxies and everything that's in it is nowhere near as impressive as the human mind. Nowhere near as impressive. There's no sight in the world that can impress one of the Gadlus HaBoire more than another human being. There's nothing so beautiful, there's nothing so deep as another human being. And that's what we mean when we say Shalom Aleichem. That's what we mean when we say I can see God in you. I can see Gadlus HaBoire in you. And imagine if that's how we really greeted one another. If you saw someone, you said, my goodness, I'm looking at you, I see God in you, I see godliness in you. Imagine if that's what we saw and if that's the way we related. And that's why we're not allowed to greet somebody else before davening. By the way, you are, if you just bump into him, you are allowed to greet him. You don't have to be rude. It's only, it says, if you go, you don't go to his house in order to greet him. But that's what a greeting should be. A greeting should be an act of worship, a religious act that actually brings into conflict the question of whether one's allowed to do it before davening or not. And look at the kind of acts, hamashkim lepischo, a person going early in the morning to somebody else's house. Also, l'odem lahakdim lepesach chaveiro liten loy sholeh. If you just look at the phrase, you can cry to realize that this doesn't get done anymore. You're not allowed to go early to another person's front door to say shalom to him. Has that ever happened to you, that somebody's come to your front door to say hello? Doesn't happen very often. Just come to say shalom aleichem. Just come to say shalom. We don't do that kind of thing anymore. If we bump into somebody, we'll say hello, if you're lucky. That already is. But to go to somebody for the purpose of saying shalom aleichem, I just want to greet you, just want to say hello, that's all. Which means that what you're really saying is, I recognize godliness in you. That's what you're really saying. I recognize you. You're important to me. That's all. Then we don't do that kind of thing anymore. We don't relate to one another that kind of that in that way anymore. How important that is. It was quite strange. I got a message just before Shabbos, a name and a phone number. So I phoned back, and apparently, I don't even remember, but apparently when the other person answered the phone, I said to him immediately, I said, is everything alright? Is there a problem? And he said, yes, just relax. What do you say excited about? I said, you know, just before Shabbos, if somebody phones with a message, there's a problem. No, they said they were just worried because they saw me and I was preoccupied. Am I all right? I thought, they just wanted to phone before Shabbos. But you know how sick it is that one, it doesn't enter one's mind that that could possibly be the reason. It doesn't enter one's mind that that could be the reason a person phones before Shabbos. It can only be one reason. They've got a problem. There's no other reason to phone before Shabbos. It's tragic that we've just lost the art of communicating with one another for no reason other than communicating friendship, caring, respect to one another. If we're communicating, there's already a reason. There must be a reason. What are you phoning for? What do you want? That's the assumption. What do you think? Just to say Shalom Aleichem, that's all. We've lost that ability because we don't understand that importance of greeting. There's the beautiful piece in the Chumash where Yosef comes to see Yaakov just before Yaakov dies. Yaakov's a very old man and he's suffered a great deal and he's about to die, he's ill, and he dresses himself up and he sits at the bed, he sits up, and Chazal asks, why does he do so? And it says, because of Kovod HaMalchus, because Yosef is a king. But Yosef is his son, doesn't matter, son or not son, but he's a king. So what we see from there is that the kovod you have to show to a melech means putting aside all your own aches and pains. It's kovod hamalchus. If a melech comes, you put aside all your own inconveniences, you put aside all your discomforts in order to show kovod to the king. There's a chazal that the Reishis Chochma brings it, that after 120 years when one comes upstairs, there are a number of questions one's asked. One of the questions is, Hinlachto es koinecho, did you make Hashem your king? So one question you're asked. The next question is, Hinlachto es chavercho, did you make your friend your king too? Now that means we've got to treat our friends with the same kind of kovod that Nota Hirsch makes this deduction. That means we've got to treat our friends with kovod hamalchus. Which means when we're talking to our friends, we've got to do as Yosef did. We've got to put aside all our own aches and pains and discomforts and show him kovod, make him feel important. That's an amazing thing that we've got to be able to do. Why is that so important? And why are the two questions put one next to the other? Him lachto es kenecho, him lachto es chavercho. Because in seeing, in understanding your friend, you see the Ribono Shel Olam. And you cannot say, yes, I worship Hashem, but I don't worship people. Because in people you see God more clearly than anywhere else. And if you can have a friend and not show him kovod, the kovod you would show to a king, then you don't understand anything about the Ribono Shel Olam either. Then it's all distant and theoretical. It's not real. If you really are showing kovod to Hashem, you'll show kovod to human beings as well. Because in human beings you'll see something of the Ribono Shel Olam. That's the degree of kovod that we need to show, that we need to be able to develop for one another. I think I mentioned in one of the shiurim recently, but it's worth repeating if I didn't, that there's a fellow that's going around. He used to be involved in business, I think in the accounting profession, and he then became a game ranger. He just decided enough of business and he wanted to go into nature, and he became a game ranger. Went into the wild and he was a game ranger, did a lot of interesting photography there. And then that he wasn't earning enough money with that, so now he wanted to combine his two professions. So what he did is, by studying the animals, he developed certain management techniques. And he goes around to companies and they pay him a lot of money, and he shows them slides of how the teams of animals manage one another, how they function as teams. And he shows how those same principles can be used in business. And it was interesting, he came to a company that I just finished with. And usually this fellow is very successful. In this company he wasn't so successful. And I asked them afterwards why. Well, they said at first they thought it was a bit superficial. Secondly, they said it doesn't work. I said, what doesn't work? Everybody else that this man shows his films to gets very excited. What doesn't work? They said, because we're not animals. So I said, what does that mean? But he showed you how lions work as a team, and he showed you how wild dogs work as a team. What is there? What's missing? What is there? In what way are you not animals in that sense of team operation? And they said, one of them then said to me that the title of his talk was called The Pride of the Lion. And that's what the talk was about. He said, and he's right, lions are very proud animals. And they work with that pride. But I never saw a lion making another lion feel proud. We're not animals, we're human beings. We can make each other feel proud. That's what COVID is. COVID is not to feel proud. COVID is the ability to make somebody else feel proud. And the moment you make somebody else feel proud, he opens his door to you. He's willing to let you in. But we're afraid to make other people feel proud because we are so lacking in self-esteem ourselves that we feel threatened the moment we make other people feel choshuv, the moment we make other people feel important. I was sitting in the aeroplane on last Tuesday morning, I think it was, and I'd just taken my seat and just looked around to make sure there was nobody in the section of the plane that I was in that I knew, saw that there wasn't, so I began to relax. At that, a man comes and sits down next to me, checked to see that I didn't know him either, so that's perfect, fine, I'm ready to have a relaxing hour. At that, another man comes and says to the man sitting next to me, can I swap places with you? I said, sure. Guy sits down, introduces himself to me, and he says, I have to speak to you, especially there are a lot of questions I want to ask you, he says, but there's something more important. I want to tell you that I love learning Torah. I love learning Torah, and a day doesn't go in my life that I don't learn. I said, I'm very happy to hear that. He said, I love it with a passion. Sitting there without a yarmulke. He said, I love it with a passion. He said, but more important, I want to tell you why, how come? He says, when I was a little boy, I used to go to the yeshiva college, and your father taught me. And I asked a question once, and it was a silly question. But it wasn't such a silly question. He says, for me, I put a lot of work into that question, but after I asked it, I realized it wasn't really such a good question. And he said, your father stopped the class, and he built my question into the question of Erishon. And he made me feel so good, and so important. And he showed the class the value of this question. He said, that gave me a cheshit to learn Torah that I've never lost. From that day onwards, I've never missed a day of learning Torah. That's the power of making another person feel proud, of making another person feel important. There is no greater educational tool. There is no greater social tool. There is no greater business tool than making the other person feeling that COVID. The door is open. There is a king. How do you get in to see a king? How do you get an appointment with a king? How long do you have to wait before you can, especially if you're just a builder? How do you get into the melech? This fellow gets right in. How does he get in? Because he showed the melech covered, he made the king feel proud. Moshe Rabbeinu gets right, lifnim, gets right into the core of the Mishkan, where nobody else is allowed. Moshe is invited in. How does he achieve it? Respect the Ribbono Shel Olam's dignity and covered, and builds it. And you would say that the Ribbono Shel Olam doesn't need us to build his covered. Doesn't matter, we see from there that he does. That covered again is not a human failing. COVID is a godly necessity. It's part of a godly life. It becomes perverted and sick when we have to run after our own COVID. But there's one way we can help each other not have to run after our own COVID, and that's by protecting each other's COVID. If we protect each other's COVID, people don't have to run after their own COVID. When we find people running after their own COVID, it's very often our fault, not theirs, because we're not showing them sufficient dignity. And that we need to realize applies in every phase of our life, in with every human being in whom we come, into whose contact we come, unless he's a Rosh, unless he's a real nobody, a real nothing, that has no right for that COVID. But generally we don't come into contact with those kind of people. Generally we come into contact with fine people who have important elements to them, who have contributions to make, who are intelligent, who are noble, who have aspects of greatness to them. Something in every person we come across, one usually finds that. And we have to be able to relate to them, not as the lion relates with his own pride and dignity intact, but as a human being relates, able to be mamlich chavercho, able to make your friend feel like a king. That's what's important. To be mamlich the chaver, to build his palace for him. And on every pillar and on every beam and on every wall, to be kosev shmoy shelo. To write his name there, to imprint his name there, to put him at center stage, to be concerned with not the way you're feeling, but with the way he's feeling. Until he comes in and responds to that, and says, This person has given me so much COVID. Is it right that I exclude him? Is it right that he's outside and I'm inside? Call my friend in. Let him come close to me. Let him be close to me. Let us be close together. Because we respect one another. Because we admire one another. Because we're able to be mamlich one another.